part of the confusion, Your Honor, is the finality discussion in Best. Debinger itself, of course, allows the government to create extraordinary relief, but I believe, I could be mistaken, but I believe that either in Redding or Caprio, the majority itself admits that we don't really know why we're creating this, but because we've allowed the government to do extraordinary writ petitions up to the Court of Military Appeals, that's why we're going to allow the accused to also do extraordinary writ petitions. I believe that was the majority saying that we don't really have a clear basis for doing this. I think it was the Caprio case.
I don't believe Redding said that. My recollection is Redding looked at Article 67, what we now call Article 67A2, and said that there's a specific purpose for allowing the Judge Advocate General to certify cases to this court. It's aside from all the questions of civilian supremacy that were talked about earlier, let's assume that we were an entire military court. It would appear that Redding would have come to the same conclusion because it emphasized the important underlying purpose of the code of having uniformity of decision among the services as well as within the services.
That's right. Well, Debinger, if I can lay out the government's position for Debinger, Debinger allows the government to do extra petitions. No problem with that. That's an extra issue. That's distinguishable. Redding, which decided that JAGS could certify the issues, I think there was the dissent by Fletcher in that case, which the government feels is a strong dissent. They said that the JAGS could certify the extra decisions of the Courts of Criminal Appeals via now 67C2. But again, there is no Article 66 review, which is the government's position is the predicate to find jurisdiction in this court. Now, Goldsmith, of course, pulled out that language, and they said that that's, in the Goldsmith, I think it's footnote 5, they said that's the seminal jurisdictional door for this court. That this Congress, I believe the quote was, Congress can find this court's jurisdiction to the review of specified sentences imposed by courts.
But your argument is that Goldsmith doesn't really mean that, isn't it? That Goldsmith identified that as the ultimate jurisdictional responsibility of the court, but in your view, it doesn't preclude extraordinary writs, so that you read Goldsmith differently from the government counsel who previously argued extraordinary writs case that says Goldsmith means that's the only thing you can do.
I'm not sure if I understand your question correctly, Lana, but
you're not arguing that Goldsmith means that we have to have findings and sentence in order to have an extraordinary writ.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're saying that language in Goldsmith is really talking about our ultimate jurisdiction in the case,
and
it doesn't preclude extraordinary writs.
Well, they're talking about extraordinary writs specifically, but I mean, they're also talking about, they cite when they make that statement in the footnote, of course, it's a footnote because it doesn't relate to the main holding in that case, which has to do with something that's outside the realm of military justice. But where they're talking about the jurisdiction of this court, they're saying that the jurisdiction of this court was created limited to findings and sentence. So they're looking to the findings and sentence, which is in 67C1, I think, where they're talking about the findings and sentence. Clearly, you're looking at potential jurisdiction when you're looking at extraordinary writs. So the government's position is that, yes, extraordinary writs can get up to this court, no problem. They can get to the Courts of Criminal Appeals as well, or perhaps even from the Courts of Criminal Appeals to here, an extraordinary writ could be had, which the government asks that this court treat appellant's case constructively as if it agrees with the government about the jurisdictional question. And I think that gets back to the Redding and the Caprio cases, because those were, in the language of Fletcher, I think in his dissent, he said, today, with that in the Colorado statute, the majority creates an independent right of appeal in the government of the writs area. It's clear that wasn't in 67 when it was first enacted. And what was happening was constructively jurisdiction was created to bring all writs appeals into Article 67, into the whole jurisdictional scheme that's been created by Congress.
Of course, did the Court of Military Appeals have all writs jurisdiction in 1952?
I don't know when the Act was passed, Your Honor, but since the Act was passed, certainly, Your Honor. All writs Act jurisdiction.
Okay, there wasn't an amendment of 67. You're not saying amendment of 67 was necessary to give us all writs Act jurisdiction.
I'm not making that contention, but whenever the Ulrichs Act...
leaving aside when it was enacted.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, are you finished, Judge Stuckey?
Go ahead.
I just want to make sure that I am able to distinguish your argument with respect to extraordinary writs as opposed to what's happened in this case. Is your argument that appellant can't take an appeal from an Article 62 case, which the government brought to the CCA via Article 67A3, but that it could instead bring an extraordinary writ? Because even though we're not at the 67A3 stage now, potentially one day we could be?
Yes, Your Honor. If there was whatever the test may be for that specific extraordinary writ they're asking for, if it's a judicial usurpation of power, or the courts of criminal appeals are eschewing the rules, the mandatory obligations, and I think even for discretionary matters, if it's such a usurpation of power, sometimes extraordinary writs may arise. So certainly in some cases there could be an extraordinary writ that can be brought from lower to this court.
So the reason that it would be different would be because the standard for granting it would be different? I mean, is that why it matters?
Yes, Your Honor, because the standard is different. It's not just good cause. It's a higher standard for extraordinary writs. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Is this statutory scheme ambiguous?
No, Your Honor. It has been held by the Court of Military Appeals that it was ambiguous, but the language itself is very clear.
Well, you seem to suggest on page 20 of your brief that it is, because you advance several alternative...
Yes, sir.
Several alternative interpretations, and you say, but take it in context, it's not.
Yes, Your Honor, I don't want to be disingenuous. It can be, if taken after Article 62, to be internally ambiguous.
In that case, why don't we look to legislative history, and all the legislative history seems to point the opposite direction from what you're arguing.
Well, no, I disagree with that, Your Honor.
Okay, well, point me to some legislative history that points the way you're arguing.
Well, first of all, okay, I'll answer that question first since you asked it, Your Honor. Senator Jepson's language, of course, which suggested that we need to include something in here saying that you can't appeal up to the Court of Military Appeals. Well, the fact that that's not in there, several arguments could be advanced for the fact that that's not in there. Of course, because this court is an Article I court and its jurisdiction is strictly circumscribed, you can't just by implication find, or a court can't by implication find jurisdiction, number one. Number two, Best's reading of the findings and sentence requirement was, in some sense at least, the law of the land at that time. So including Senator Jepson's language would be superfluous.
So that the language in Redding didn't exist? I understand your argument that it was incorrect.
Yes, Your Honor.
But would Senator Jepson and those advising him have simply come to the same conclusion? Oh, we don't have to put in this language to block review by the Court of Military Appeals because that Redding decision was wrong.
Well, the Redding decision, the capital decision, no, Your Honor, I don't think that it didn't exist, but it was an X-ray situation, so it's different than a situation where we've got findings and sentence. So
my recollection is that in Redding, the court had two motions before it, an extraordinary writ and an Article 67A2 certification, and the court expressly did not act on the writ and expressly act on the Article 67A2 certification in order to make it clear that this court had jurisdiction under Article 67A2 over interlocutory matters. Now, that may be incorrect. It may have been an incorrect decision, as you argue. But in terms of answering Judge Stuckey's question, was that not the state of the law that was before the Congress in terms of interpreting what action that Congress took at that time?
Yes, Your Honor, number one, but number two, the state of the law at the time doesn't have anything to do, again, with what Congress enacts. The Congress enacts a statutory scheme, jurisdictional scheme that's outside the...
No question there right now as to whether jurisdiction is determined by the statute or by legislative history, separate from the statute. My understanding of Judge Stuckey's question was to ask you what in the legislative history, if we get to the point of looking at legislative history, shows that Congress had an intent contrary to the language that was expressly in the committee report.
Senator Jepson's language not being in there, first of all, could as part of the legislative history, his language not being in the statute can be seen equally to be Congress not wanting to muddy the ex-writ appeal process. If that language was in there, he wanted to say there's no appeal that might be held up to the Court of Military Appeals. That can be seen as Congress not wanting to say there is an appellate route for ex-writs. You still may bring an ex-writ from the Court of Criminal Appeals to Court of Military Appeals. Had his language been in there, that would have muddied the process. So that's one part of the legislative history that goes in favor of the government's reading. Second, Secretary Taft, which the defense makes use of, surprisingly actually goes against defense's position. Secretary Taft called specifically for, in the footnote of defense's brief, a clear statutory scheme so that appeals may be had up to the Court of Military Appeals. In the Article 62 process. That's not there. There's no clear statutory scheme that was a scheme.
There's no clear statutory scheme, so it sounds to me like there's ambiguity, which means you got to fall back on the legislative history, and you got one clear statement in the legislative history, and it's contrary to your position. You're arguing in the face of fairly clear legislative history from the absence of statutory provisions that were proposed. And
I think I misspoke, Your Honor. Senator Taft's language was, and he said that I'm calling for a clear statutory right of appeal from the Court of Criminal Appeals up to the Court of Military Appeals. Article 62, number one. Number two, Article 62 was enacted. Number three, when you look at
okay, you're saying because he called for a clear statutory provision and the statute says X, therefore that's that's more your position.
Yes, it's okay. Clear the opposite way. It's not that it's ambiguous, but it's clear okay. The opposite way that findings and sentence are required.
Counsel, would you then address Mr. Taft's statement on page 85 of the committee report, in which it's a direct question from Senator Exon. For the record, who determines whether the particular order meets the criteria for the government to be able to exercise its right to appeal? And he describes how it would be made by the trial counsel, manual and service regulations will provide who represents the government before the Court of Military Review under Article 70. And then he says, quote, further appeal to the Court of Military Appeals will be subject to additional procedural requirements for approval under the manual for courts, martial and service regulations. The determination as to whether the appeal meets the criteria of Article 62 as proposed will be subject to review by appellate authorities.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the language that then is embodied in the report.
Yes, Your Honor.
Senator Exon asks a question, the executive branch answers it, and the committee puts it in a report.
Yes, Your Honor, but that's it's simply not there in the statute, the findings and sentence.
At no point in that response does he say that anything has to be in the statute. He says this is the way it will be done by the executive branch. This is the way we're going to administer the statute.
Yes, sir. And he could just as well be talking about ex-writs, taking ex-writ from the Court of Criminal Appeals decision of an and it's not a decision. I mean, I think that gets back to the plain text of the statute.
The question by Senator Exon is about appeals to by the government.
Well, then, if that's the answer, then that's just wrong, Your Honor, because that's not in the statute. It's not in the plain language of the statute.
So,
and again, hewing towards strictly circumscribing jurisdiction.
So this is all fatuous?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
This discussion, this testimony that Congress took pains to ask the questions and put it in its report is all surplusage?
Well, I think the government cited in its brief an example of another congressional report, which was simply wrong. It's not unheard of that a congressional report is wrong.
But so in other words, as I asked counsel in the last, you know, the Armed Services Committee didn't know what it was doing.
Well, no, it was just wrong, Your Honor. I mean, the statute
is just wrong in what sense? In that if the report language and the statute don't meet up?
Yes, Your Honor. If he's talking about an Article 62 appeal other than an ex-writ, that's not an Article 62 or 67, period. That's the government's position, Your Honor.
Okay. Can I ask you a question about searches?
Yes, Your Honor.
That has something to do with this case, perhaps. What did the military judge get wrong as a matter of law?
A finding that the search was avoidable, that the looking into the laptop was avoidable, that he could have done something else than looking inside the laptop to find its true owner. Fourth Amendment searches must be reasonable. Here, we've got a laptop that was lost.
That's the CCA's argument that it's a misapplication of Conklin and the Fourth Amendment does not require a sort of exhaustion or remedies approach. Why was the search reasonable?
Number one, it wasn't a quest for evidence. It was to determine the ownership of the laptop. And I think that there is law that's both military justice and otherwise. The Jasper case, opening mail, determining the ownership of...
I'm sorry, you're going to list a number of factors?
I was one of those cases that supported the same conclusion.
Other factors? I mean, at what point does that mean it can never be unreasonable?
In this case, Your Honor, if there had only been, if on asking how many Joshes there was one Josh and only one Josh, then perhaps it would have been unreasonable.
This is the case of the three Joshes. The one Josh, so the appellant was arguing you can never have too many Joshes, and you're arguing the one Josh rule.
Are you joshing?
So there's no, the judge found that it's a personal computer. You don't take issue with that. The judge found that it was lost. The judge found that you've got the Josh issue.
And I'm not sure.
So he can go rifling through different files and say, oh, this is interesting. Let's see who he's writing.
Well, it was a reasonable search to find out who the owner of the computer was. I think those steps would occur to any reasonable person trying to determine who the computer was. If there's no markings on the computer, turn the computer on, look inside it. It's part of cleaning the barracks that they found the computer. It was sitting there with no owner. Lost property, no privacy interest because it's lost property.
And what about the appellant's balancing argument? The appellant is arguing... that's great, but it doesn't balance out with the privacy interests at stake.
But the fundamental test of the Fourth Amendment analysis is whether it's reasonable. And it's a reasonable search.
Because he's a duty officer and he's trying to figure out what is this.
That's right.
Turning to paragraph 11 and arguing only in the abstract for you, let us say that the judge was correct, just for the sake of the next question. It was an unreasonable search. Would, in your view, 311 apply? It's not a trick question. It's a stipulated question. It sounds counterintuitive for you to answer, but I'm just wondering why 311 isn't in play.
If it's an unreasonable search and still it's owner's property, so there's no privacy interest implicated, then that wouldn't apply. If you're doing a balancing and you're finding that, yeah, he had an interest in it.
Let me rephrase it. If he found that it was unreasonable, must he move to the exclusionary rule or can he stop at 311? As a matter of law.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know the answer to that, John. I guess you could proceed to the exclusionary rule.
Is the judge required in applying this deterrence doctrine?
I'm sorry?
Is a judge who is applying the deterrence doctrine embedded in the exclusionary rule required as a matter of law to indicate why the rule is being applied?
I don't know the answer to that question anymore.
Shouldn't we know the answer to that question? Or are you banking this on the Article 62 piece?
He should say why he's applying exclusionary law. Yes, Your Honor.
But the part you don't know the answer to is whether it's required as a matter of law as opposed to a good idea?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it a discretionary doctrine, the exclusionary rule?
No, it's not.
Has not the court said it? So in any search where it's unreasonable, QED, the exclusionary rule, shall be applied?
If it applies to the facts of the case, Your Honor, so I guess it's discretionary in that sense.
Thank you.
Conklin was...
Counsel, I'd like to explore where we are in this case if we reach the merits and you prevail on it. Does the... accused still have the opportunity to challenge the search at the trial level at that point? That is, if we would be overturning the military judge's ruling with respect to the search up to the point of the looking at the computer and identifying this particular item. there are other aspects that went on after that. I assume those are still all open to the judge, and that our ruling is narrowly confined here in Article 62 to the specific determination by the judge in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. It's limited to the 62 ruling, Your Honor.
So that the search is still open on any other grounds that the defense wishes to make at trial?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. The military judge misapplied the Conklin test because the Conklin was applied only to inspections, and this was not an inspection. This, again, was a search of ownerless property, and it was a reasonable search at that. So, therefore, the military judge's holding should have been overturned, or was an abuse of discretion, and the Court of Criminal Appeals correctly overturned the lower court's ruling.
At what point would this become an unreasonable search? That calls for you to identify hypothetical rather than me. But is there, or another way to put it, is there any point at which, having looked at the computer and identified information that would attribute the computer to a particular individual, that going beyond that might raise the issue of an unreasonable search? And I know you're not going to want to, I think you may want to talk about it hypothetically, because this may be an issue in the case itself.
Yes, Your Honor, I think if it went too far past that identifying the other, then obviously that could be a problem. But here, that's not the case. It stopped close to identifying who the owner was. Does the court want me to go back to the Article 62 issue or to not? No more issues in Article 62.
would you wish that?
Counsel, you are at any time, any counsel before this court who is not receiving questions is welcome to conclude their argument. Or to continue it as they wish.
Yes, Your Honor. I do want to revisit very quickly the Article 62 issue of review in cases and the context of the statutes, because I think the plain text of the statute is a critical issue here that we've gone around, but I'm not sure that I've been able to get to completely. Prior to Article 62, except in extraordinary circumstances, again, there was no appeal up to this court. Except in extraordinary circumstances, there had to be some sense findings and sentence. Now, the Lee case that this court cited, the government does not believe. The Lee case stands for the proposition, as the government understands it, that when the findings and or sentence, I don't recall which was in that case, are set aside, then jurisdiction still adheres to this court.
The case specifically had before it as a result of the specified issue was, if a case doesn't meet the criteria for Article 67C, can we review it on direct review? That was the specified issue in the case.
And one of the conclusions was, as everyone understands it, was that where the findings and our sentence have been set aside, they can still review it.
One of the conclusions was that Article 67C is not jurisdictional.
Perhaps that's the case, Your Honor. The way the government read it was, where the findings and sentence were set aside, that's the language of 67C again.
Wasn't Judge Gerke's dissent in that case premised entirely upon the idea that there had not been compliance with Article 67C?
As the government recalls Judge Gerke's dissent, he said that it's possible that a case could come up here. I guess perhaps this is where that comes from. A case could come up to this court under 67A and not be able to be acted on under 67C, as the government recalls the dissent.
He said that could not happen.
That could not happen.
That was his dissent, said it couldn't happen. The majority said, four judges said that it could happen.
Yes, sir. And the government's position, of course, is that Goldsmith pulls out that 67C, and they say that's the limits, that's the boundaries of the court. Looking at the
doesn't Goldsmith specifically say that it's talking about the there's later language in the case that talking about the specific writ before it, and that there may be other circumstances?
Well, yes, Your Honor. And Best also, when the defense was citing Best says there could be extraordinary circumstances. But of course, that's what the government's position is, that there are extraordinary circumstances that can come up to this court, and that's the route of appeal, not through 62. taken also in context of the other rules. Review is language that's used. I think in the Alexander case, of course, affirmance of the findings and sentence was talked about in the Alexander case, and I said you can imply the affirmance of the findings. Findings and sentence and review are seminal parts of each one of these statutes, 66, 67, 69. 69 provides another route for getting within 67, but 62 is the one statute that doesn't provide that extra route for getting into 67. So the government's position is in fine that 67 does not allow that. I see the government's time is running out. If the government could conclude briefly.
Take the time that you need, Chancellor.
This course authority, again, is prescribed to ensure fair rights under the UCMJ that are accorded to court-martial sentences and brought before it for review. The service course rule in 1983 given an additional power to hear and rule in interlocutory appeals by the United States of certain rulings of military judges. No other enlargement of jurisdiction was made by Congress at any time after 1983. To that statute, 62 or 67. This court should therefore reverse Tucker and its progeny and either dismiss the case out of hand or treat it as an application for extraordinary relief and deny it so that per the specific language of Article 62 and 67, the court-martial process can continue and military justice, whose purpose is to reinforce good order and discipline in the armed services, may proceed in the trial court expeditiously approve the statutory scheme. Of course, the government believes that they'll try to file an X-writ, so treating it as an X-writ now and disposing of it at this level would be the most expeditious route to taking the case back quickly to trial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Honor.
Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Sir, just briefly.
At the outset, could you address the question that I asked the government counsel, and that is, what would be the posture of this case if we reach the merits and rule for the government on the merits? What will be available to you at trial? In other words, what should be the bounds of our decision should we reach the merits and rule in favor of the government in this case?
Sir, I agree with the government counsel is that basically what we're going to be stuck for, this decision will reflect just this specific part of the search. I mean, if the defense elects to file another motion to, say, suppress the opening of the files themselves, then obviously that would be open to us as well. A couple of things we wanted to clear up that the government counsel stated when he was talking about the, I guess it's a prepared statement of William Taft IV, who was the general counsel of the DOD. I believe he took the language out of context where he says, preferable to establish a clear statutory procedure for reaching the then the Court of Military Appeals than to leave it to the uncertain state of extraordinary writ practice under the All Writs Act. What I believe Mr. Taft was saying here was that he would rather have this cleared up at that level, at that point. In other words, go back to we don't support the not allowing this court to provide oversight on Article 62 appeals. And because if we do it, if we limit it as Senator Jepson wanted, then we're going to be in the All Writs Act, which is very could be very confusing and not would not help the jurisprudence of the court. The other thing, and
I want to ask a search question, but I don't want to break into your rebuttal if you have a lineup.
Well, one other thing, sir, and then I'll let you get to that. One thing about the, I guess the court brought up Judge Gerke's dissent and leak. I think it's important to note, though, that he did not raise jurisdictional issues in Boudreaux, Weymouth, Harding, or Gore when he was presented with one.
You read a majority opinion by reading the dissent to figure out what the majority opinion says?
I'm sorry, sir.
When you're trying to figure out what the court has said, do you read the dissent to determine that?
Sometimes, sir, it's enlightening.
So you read the dissent to determine what the majority said?
No, but I think it helps explain, I guess, the interactions of the court to determine why the opinions were written the way they were. I mean, obviously.
And dissents aren't ever written to accent the differences rather than to find commonality?
I'd agree with that, sir. Now, to the search and your question, sir.
Okay. Oh, yes, my question. The totality of the circumstances, right? In one of the circumstances, this is the military, and staff duty officers aren't running lost and founds. That's fair to say, right?
Yes, sir.
Well, you wouldn't dare say that to the staff duty officer in any event. So, applying the rule about, we're back to the three Josh rule, and if I understood you correctly, if you apply the 3-Josh rule, it would apply to the 10-Josh rule as well as the 11-Josh rule, as I understood in this case.
Duty officers and any other person who finds lost property is to tell them that while you are allowed, as the military judge did in this case, to try to determine ownership by going to a registration part of the computer, which, as I mentioned earlier, we don't necessarily agree with, you are not allowed to go into the personal files of the computer.
So a platoon sergeant goes under the platoon head. It's Liberty Weekend. He goes under the platoon head and there's a suitcase in there. He has to have a platoon formation now, call everybody back from leave or wherever and say, there seems to be a suitcase missing. Whose is it? Or can he open it and figure out who's? He knows it's someone from the platoon. So instead of 3 Joshes, he's got 34 Joshes. Why are you applying your rule? You're creating a rule which now would make the platoon sergeant consult the judge advocate, have a unit formation, and have a debate over whose suitcase it is.
Absolutely not, sir.
Okay, why not?
In circumstances, if he's allowed to open the suitcase, and I know the case law supports that, if he finds a letter in there, he's not allowed to open the letter. And that's what we have in the situation here, is that we believe files on the computer carry that expectation of privacy to the same level of the mail. Now, we're all, yeah.
Did he open files here? Isn't the debate when he pulled up the recent documents catalog?
I'm concerned about that is by knowing the names of the files, that could provide information to a person that would be personal under the circumstances. There, you know, you can call the file what you want to call it.
But that's like finding the letter. I mean, these parallels to other Fourth Amendment cases fall apart eventually if this suitcase ultimately is not a computer and vice versa.
And what makes this case so much more difficult is that computers are so necessarily personal, the information on them.
How will your rule apply in reality? So you have to give guidance to all staff, to the NCOs, what?
No, it's very clear. You bring them in and you say, you find a computer.
So it's computer specific.
You don't turn it on. Under the military judge's ruling, you can turn it on, you can go to the registration to try to determine ownership, and that is it. Because anything above and beyond that goes into the personal files of the person on the computer. I mean, even both Campbell and Goff admitted that they would not want their personal correspondence or that personal correspondence like that has a privacy interest in it. And Goff admitted he would have to read the files to determine if he found homework, which that's just a stretch to start with, he would have had to read the letter. Now, sir, if I may close.
Yeah, no, you answered my question. I appreciate it. So you're on your time.
Okay, sir. The last thing I didn't get a chance to talk about this was the abuse of discretion very quickly. It requires a definite, firm conviction that the court below committed a clear error of judgment. Obviously, we believe that the military judge did not do that, and the Marine Court, language that he appears to apply an erroneous standard of reasonableness. So clearly, if they didn't know whether he did or didn't, then how can they have a definite and firm conviction that they actually made a mistake? The case law is clear that he has a range of options. He elected, using Conklin as a guide, to set some boundaries to this type of search, and under the circumstances, it was reasonable. That's all that's required, so therefore his ruling was not clearly erroneous. In conclusion, his findings of fact were supported by the testimony at trial, the military judges that were in his ruling, and that were not clearly erroneous. And his conclusion of law were in line with the current state of the law, and as such, he did not abuse his discretion, and there was no clear error of judgment. As far as the search was concerned, and of course, as far as this court's jurisdiction, we believe that Turner was rightfully decided and should remain the law. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation here today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned.
Court stands adjourned.